This was a most improbable celebrity. In his mid-twenties, slightly built and of middling height, he seemed diffident, even affected. He was also permanently cross-eyed, the result of childhood measles, which earned him the nickname Dr. Squintum. And the prospect of speaking in public often made him feel physically sick. Yet George Whitefield was America's first cult hero, a man renowned across all the colonies in the 1740s. And he was a preacher. Young Whitefield, the son of a Bristol innkeeper, was a natural mimic. Having gone through a conversion experience while at Oxford, he used his theatrical skills to preach the gospel in new and dramatic ways. In 1740, his preaching tour along the east coast of America sparked what was called the Great Awakening, part of a fundamental and enduring transformation of American life. As we'll see, it shook up the social order and even reached across the racial divide. Early on October the 23rd, 1740, a Connecticut farmer called Nathan Cole heard that Whitefield would be preaching at nearby Middletown later that morning. Cole immediately saddled his horse. He and his wife rode it together. As they neared the main road from Hartford into Middletown, Cole saw what seemed like a dense fog rising from the river. But on getting closer, he realized it was a huge cloud of dust stirred up by horses' hooves.
I could see men and horses slipping along in the cloud like shadows. And as I drew nearer, it seemed like a steady stream of horses and their riders. Scarcely a horse more than a length behind another. All of a lather and foam with sweat, their breath rolling out of their nostrils every jump. Every horse seemed to go with all his might for the saving of souls.
Cole squeezed his horse into a gap, and like a great stream they all flowed into Middletown. No one spoke, so eager were they to arrive in time. But his wife did mutter through the dust,
"Law, our clothes will be all spoiled."
Whitefield was preaching in the open air. To Cole,
he looked almost angelical, a young, slim, slender youth, before some thousands of people, with a bold, undaunted countenance, as if he were clothed with authority from the great God, and a sweet, solemn solemnity sat on his brow.
The crowd that day was estimated at 3,000 or 4,000. In Boston and Philadelphia, Whitefield's open-air preaching would often draw double that number, more than half the population. People were riveted as he conjured up the torments of hell, tears often rolling down his cheeks, or acted out biblical stories like Abraham about to sacrifice his son Isaac. Always the message was the same, a call to be born anew in the Holy Spirit. Here's Whitefield's account of one of his sermons in Savannah, Georgia.
When we came to public prayer, the Holy Ghost seemed to come into the congregation like a mighty rushing wind, carrying all before it. I had not long begun before several fell a weeping sorely, and the number still increased till young men and maidens, old men and children were all dissolved in tears and mourning after Jesus. I believe there were scarcely half a dozen in the whole congregation, but what were deeply affected. I never saw the like before. An effectual door is opening in America, and I trust the time is coming when the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the Lord, as the waters cover the sea.
But the religious awakening of the early 1740s wasn't a one-man show. Many others, apart from Whitefield, preached in this new style. In fact, historians now talk not of a one-off Great Awakening, but about a series of religious revivals right across America that rumbled on well into the 19th century. The hallmarks of these revivals were dramatic conversion experiences and fervent communities of believers, often very egalitarian in nature, all of which challenged the authority of the older hierarchical churches of New England or the Anglican South. And the revivals laid the ground for dynamic new denominations, such as the Methodists and Baptists. The Baptists hit Virginia in the 1770s. Traditional Anglican services there were largely a recital of the Book of Common Prayer, and local parsons operated at the beck and call of the big landowners. The Baptists, by contrast, followed the Spirit in their own ways, often in improvised places of worship, almost thumbing their noses at the local elite. A leading Baptist preacher in Virginia was John Waller, known before his conversion as Swearing Jack. One Sunday, he was holding an open-air service when the parson, the sheriff, and other local worthies rode up. According to one account, while Waller was singing,
"The parson of the parish would keep laying his whip across the hymn book, etc. When done his singing, Waller proceeded to prayer. In it, he was violently jerked off of the stage. They caught him by the back part of his neck, beat his head against the ground, then carried him through a gate that stood some considerable distance, where a gentleman, the sheriff, gave him 20 lashes with his horsewhip. Then Brother Waller was released, went back singing praise to God, mounted the stage, and preached with a great deal of liberty."
The popularity of revivalist religion reflected larger social and economic changes in the colonies. Although the South was still predominantly rural, the Middle Colonies and New England had many more towns and cities, some of which had grown to 15,000 or more. The cities were complex webs of information capable of sustaining their own newspapers. Press reports of Whitfield's reception in one place helped swell his audience elsewhere. Not merely the cities, but the whole population had grown. By 1750, there were 1.2 million people in the North American colonies, nearly five times the figure for 1700. Now, unlike the 17th century, English migrants were a distinct minority. Many of them weren't productive farmers, but convicts shipped out to serve their sentences. The English were outnumbered by German immigrants. Even more numerous were the Scots, both Protestants from Ulster, known in the colonies as Scots-Irish, and Highlanders, whose clan system had been smashed after the Jacobite Rebellion of 1745. One group of emigrants from the Inverness area summed up America's attractions as follows.
"The price of land is so low that 40 or 50 pounds will purchase as much ground as 1,000 in this country. There are few or no taxes at present in the colonies. The climate in general is very healthy. Lastly, there are no titled proud lords to tyrannize over the lower sort of people, men there being upon a level, and more valued in proportion to their abilities than they are in Scotland."
English felons aside, most of these immigrants had crossed the Atlantic willingly, even if some of them had to serve for a period of years to pay off the cost of their passage. But this migration from Europe was matched in the years 1700 to 1775 by the forced movement of around a quarter of a million Africans. The Atlantic network of commerce and communication that attracted Scots and Germans also made the slave trade an integral part of American history. The land of the free was becoming the home of the slave. Atlantic slave trading was now big business. Each decade in the middle of the 18th century, over 500,000 Africans were shipped across the Atlantic, the bulk of them to the Caribbean and Brazil, but many to North America. This wasn't simply a story of white exploiting black, because the slave trade was organised at the African end by Africans, and more slaves probably died in transit to the West African coast than in crossing the Atlantic. That said, however, the Middle Passage was a nightmare. The slaves were chained below decks and stacked on wooden shelves about 6 feet long, 16 inches wide, and 30 inches high. Even convicts got more space. They slept without bedding, often in their own urine and excrement, and were only brought above decks briefly twice a day for food and exercise. Many died of disease, especially a form of dysentery known as the bloody flux. Some starved themselves to death out of depression, or tried to jump overboard. Olauda Equiano was kidnapped at age 11 from a village in the Kingdom of Benin and taken to the African coast en route for Virginia. Having never seen a ship before, let alone a white man, Equiano believed at first that they lived all their lives in this hollow place and couldn't imagine how pieces of cloth on the mast could make the ship move. He assumed this was all some form of magic. Below decks, he recalled,
"The closeness of the place and the heat of the climate added to the number in the ship, which was so crowded that each had scarcely room to turn himself, almost suffocated us. This produced copious perspirations, so that the air soon became unfit for respiration from a variety of loathsome smells, and brought on a sickness among the slaves, of which many died, thus falling victims to the improvident avarice, as I may call it, of their purchasers. This wretched situation was again aggravated by the galling of the chains, now become insupportable, and the filth of the necessary tubs, into which the children often fell and were almost suffocated. The shrieks of the women and the groans of the dying rendered the whole a scene of horror almost inconceivable.
Africans brought with them across the Atlantic their own languages, religions, and customs, including the widespread practice of polygamy, of having several wives. But in America, they developed new cultures, drawing partly on colonial ways. And one of the most powerful influences was evangelical religion. The Baptist and Methodist message of new birth chimed in with the idea of regeneration in some African religions. And John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, came out vehemently against slavery. The preacher George Whitefield didn't, but he had no doubt that the gospel was for blacks as much as whites. The Methodists even sent out from England a black missionary to evangelize the slaves, attaching him to the orphanage Whitefield had built in Savannah, Georgia. This missionary, a young man called David Margate, arrived in 1775 and initially made a good impression on the head of the orphanage, Reverend William Piercy, who noted,
"He appears pious and devoted, and I do hope the Lord will make him a great blessing to these poor heathen around us."
But after hearing Margate preach, Piercy wasn't so sure.
"I rather fear he should speak imprudently to the black people."
Then Margate took as his wife a woman who was already married to a slave, and started claiming he was a second Moses, called to deliver his people from slavery. Trying to understand such conduct, Reverend Piercy concluded,
"A great part arises from his pride. His pride seems so great that he can't bear to think of any of his color being slaves. There was no making him sensible of the state of the blacks in this country."
After Margate had had the temerity to preach against Egyptian bondage from the pulpits of Charleston, a group of whites, haunted as usual by the nightmare of slave revolts, banded together to form a lynch mob. In the nick of time, Piercy spirited Margate onto a ship back to England. The black missionary had been in the colonies little more than 6 months, but he created shockwaves that took years to subside. So evangelical religion was a disruptive force, unsettling the norms of religious and social life. For blacks, even more than for whites, its message of liberation could be explosive. And evangelicalism would keep stirring up America for many decades to come.